Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, June 8th, 1999. In the fireside room this morning is Joel Oines. Today's session number is 99-1, and it's titled Science and Faith. Let's listen in.
Today we'll be talking mainly about sort of preliminary stuff about faith, about the faith, and about science. And it's sort of arid territory after all the good Bible studies, and when you're in a community that finally speaks the language of faith and have none of those other distractions, to have to go back and revisit something that we sort of left behind. And so that sort of puts me in an odd spot. I can tell you a little bit about myself. I'm not sure I have a lot of credentials for this. I'm a part-time pastor, and it's in a small rural congregation of about 20 families. I am also a high school physics teacher, and so I teach the introductory physics course. Still lots of unwilling students. It's one of the very few science options in this little school. And I found that it's been beneficial for me because being the physics teacher and the Lutheran pastor gives me enormous authority in both of those fields. At least in the little town, I enjoy a lot of respect that I probably don't deserve. And the third part of my job these days is that I'm the computer network administrator for my school, and it's rather advanced in the cyber age, so I end up administering and worrying about this technology that sort of is leading us down this commercial and directionless path. And so I'm immersed in the application of the science that I love, but that seems to be really a waste of time. Diane, you're a mainframe programmer. So you understand what I'm saying. So that's sort of where I'm at. And I can't speak from a lot of... I'm not an expert, but I've been in a unique position to see sort of how people learn science and how questions of science and faith sort of interact and meet. And so I'm sharing it from that perspective. And what we'll do today, first, I'll give you some, I want to hear from you first about your experience with faith and science. And then I'll give you a definition. What I've sort of come up with is, it's not any sort of definitive definition. I'll write it on the board, and then we'll sort of look at it, and you can destroy it if you like. But there's some things that I want you to notice in the definition. As Christians, the things that are important in that definition of science. Then I'll draw a picture on here, and I'll use the picture to illustrate what I think are the issues that science confronts Christians with. And then we'll try to make some observations from that. And so the first thing is to hear from you, and I'll just give you just some brief introductory remarks. When we teach high school physics, we usually start with Galileo. We start with motion, masses in motion. We do mechanics. And Western science, at least the introductory physics, starts with him. And physics is rather arrogant among the science. They regard themselves as the hard science. Not hard as compared to easy, but hard in relation to soft. It's the hard science. And you know, physicists have their nose in the air because they are the real scientists. And so people come expecting that in class. And we start with Galileo, which is, interestingly enough, is also sort of the benchmark where the church began to have real conflicts with this emerging discipline of knowledge called science. It wasn't even called that at the time. But that was where it began. And we all know that the church forced Galileo to renounce his assertion that it was the sun that didn't move and the earth went around the sun. And he had to do that, and did it rather, I think, unwillingly. But ever after, there has always been this sort of antagonism. And It started as a church quarrel, and Galileo's situation was that it was an Italian church quarrel, and he was related to certain folks up in Venice who hated the Vatican, and the Vatican had a group of scholars that thought the Venetians were really marginal, and so it started as a church squabble. And slowly, science, and its very different methodology and way of knowing began to really threaten the church. The church always kind of maintained control over it. And then somewhere along the way, some people, I don't know where it started, but some people say it was the Reformation, somehow freed inquiry from the control of the faith. And there got to be more and more animosity, and then sort of scientists began sort of renouncing, not necessarily the articles of faith first, but the control that the church seemed to need over the inquiry that science was engaging in. And it slowly got to be more and more hostile, and finally science began to detach from the church, and it became sort of irrelevant. And I think for Americans and for Western Europe, the critical moment was when Darwin published The Origin of Species, and it was when the war was declared, and it really did emerge in all the literature and all the people commenting on it were talking about war and conflict, and it sort of exhausted itself in the 20s, and then it's sort of been an indifference since then. And I think there are signs that science is and religion are starting to see that they have some of the same concerns. And so I was just going to tell you a couple of stories here, and we'll do this maybe for 10 minutes, then we'll go on. But the story, I think the first time this conflict occurred to me, I was a little boy. This is the late 50s or early 60s. I don't remember when Yuri Gagarin went up into space. Do you remember when that was? I think Sputnik. We were behind in the space race. The godless communists were ahead of us. And when was it?
September 57.
September 57 was Sputnik.
Yeah.
And then then Alan Shepard went up in 61. Yuri Gagarin after that.
60? 60, I think it was right before.
Okay. Well, I was just a young boy, and I remember the news reports that Yuri Gagarin had reported from space that he said, "I see no God," or some words. And I was, well, maybe 12, I was indignant. But I remember also that that I thought, how can he be so stupid? You know, that I was amazed, sort of stunned at the naivete. And I didn't really realize that that it was sort of a political statement. But I remember being stunned at how simple, simplistic that understanding of God was. That what got into orbit and couldn't see. Of course you couldn't see God. God is unseen. And I think that Christians do have that experience of sort of meeting the scientific world early and making some adaptations. And very early on, people who live in a scientific age are working this out. Because I didn't know a whole lot about the story of Genesis, but I did realize that his concept of God was a little small. I'll give you a second one. And this maybe relates to what Charlie was saying at the Bible study this morning. And it's something more current, and that is that whenever I'm in a hospital situation, whenever I'm working, I worked as a chaplain on internship, and when I visit my parishioners in the hospital, and some of my parishioners are chronically and terminally ill, I always have this dread that I'm not doing enough, that somehow it's a conviction that we aren't healing as we should, but it's also a deference to the medical profession. They're the ones that really fix people up, and I'm sort of a you know, sort of a fixture standing in the corner. I've got my little book under my arm, and when the doctor's finished doing the real work, then I can come on and say some words. And it's really a kind of a helpless feeling. And yet every time, the people who are gravely ill and need the doctors and putting a lot of hope in the doctors are glad to see me. And it's not because I'm a nice guy and, you know, tell jokes and I make them feel better. But it's because there's something more to illness and to getting well than the medical profession, than science can offer. Now, I've told you two stories. Maybe you could come back with some of your stories.
I'm a social scientist by training, not a soft scientist, a social scientist.
Well, I'm not a physicist, so I apologize for your errors.
That's fine, as opposed to being a physical scientist.
Yeah.
And I'm, at least in the social sciences, there is a move that suggests that faith and science really does fit together to some degree. They're beginning to mesh together. And an example I might offer, you know, picking up on what you're talking about, that people being glad to see you because you're bringing them the faith, there really is evidence to suggest that, you know, let me just say it in kind of the social science terms, and then you can translate that to the faith terms. That social support, you're offering social support to those folks, and a special type of social support that really does have a positive impact on immune system functioning. Kind of that interplay of biopsychosocial stuff. So I don't know if that was the kind of story you were looking for, but.
Yeah, well, it is. That's one where the relationship is positive, yeah.
Okay, my undergraduate work is in human foods and nutrition, so hard science. I have now shifted to a social science. And in between, part of the transition was as a hospice employee. And where was I going with this? So to follow up on Chuck. Lots of understanding within hospice circles of the value of spirituality, of medical science, of the range. I think I see it on maybe not even a continuum. It's just all a part of the whole.
Mm-hmm.
It's all a part of the gifts that we're given. The hard science learning, the social science learning.
Then it does fit and work together.
It fits and works together. And at the place where I am now, I'm extremely fond of chaos theory. Which states that while there may not be predictability, there certainly is order.
Yeah, physicists, I don't think, are on chaos theory. Okay. Well, that's encouraging here, Charlie.
I don't know how many of you saw the interview on public television with, I think it's Ian Barber, who got the Templeton Prize. You know, Templeton's trying to bring those disciplines together, and it's very fascinating because his take on it is that the people who are into cosmology are the scientists most likely to make common cause with religious people, and that the physicists and the folks who are more concerned about the mechanics, you know, it's almost like the image of the Gregorian, you know, not in one sense one isn't going to find God in the atoms and in the mechanisms of how things work,
mm-hmm.
but out on the edges and on where the bigger questions are explored. It was a very interesting articulation, I think, of where he saw the places of that interface and beginning, and because his way of stating was they're asking about the same things, the questions mm-hmm. are.
Okay.
And the fact that even Hawkins and others haven't figured out what time is yet.
It's interesting, yeah. And maybe this sort of decline of scientific confidence that has been part of that. And that's been something kind of recent. I'm really surprised to hear the first three stories were all positive.
Well, I'll argue, well, it's not so much negative, but it was very disorienting because the my college years were the same time that I sort of discovered an evangelical dimension to my Christian faith and became born again and immersed myself in evangelical Christianity and reading the Bible. It was just a very exciting time. But it was also the time when I was starting to study geology, which I was equally passionate about and loved learning about the earth. And I remember both sides telling me that I couldn't do both. I had a geology professor who was very anti-religion mm-hmm. and anti-Christianity in particular, and just assumed that if you're a Christian that you were a fundamentalist literalist.
Yeah.
And then I had a lot of Christian people who were also telling me that even delighting in the wonders of the earth was Satan's temptation, because soon I would be, you know, following evolution and following these kinds of things. And so I was finding both of these things extremely wonderful parts of who I was, but they were so many people on each side were trying to wrench them apart. Mm. And for whatever reason, I never found them incompatible, but my life since then, I continue to love the sciences, I continue to love spirituality, faith, religion, and how to weave them together is all an ongoing challenge.
But you felt that they've been sort of integrated in your life, but they're people pulling.
Well, what I found is the further I got into science, the more, I mean, the basic teachings about God is that God's unfathomable, God is bigger than we can ever think, all these things, and that's what I experienced with science. The further you go into science, the more inexplicable at some level the entire cosmos becomes. We can learn more and more about things, but behind every discovery are more questions. And so we can learn how gravity operates, but what gravity itself is remains elusive. And or when we were studying physics and learning about light, how can we be both a particle and a wave? And these, so I just found the more I learned about the universe, the more incredible it became, and that deepened my faith rather than challenged it. But I never got hung up on like a literalistic interpretation of Genesis.
Yeah. Yeah. Anybody else have that sort of experience?
Exactly that experience. The deeper I get into science, and physics is actually one of my favorite areas of science, the more deeply connected to the faith I am. The questions just are fascinating, and the unfathomability of God just keeps opening up to me. And I serve as a computer support person here too, so I guess I connected both in that struggle of the trying to keep things organized and just so, and the human interaction that we have here.
It's a moving target, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Just by a practical, I think, illustration, often, I think this is particularly in the Northwest because I've worked in nursing in the Midwest, that the Northwest doesn't even necessarily provide a chapel area in hospitals. And if there is a chapel, lots of times the staff doesn't know where it is. And I just think that says something about how they've not integrated spirituality into their care.
Mm-hmm. I have a slightly different story. I was raised by a physicist. My father has all the appropriate degrees and all that sort of stuff. And religion really didn't play any part in my upbringing. I went on, to my father's dismay, to become a philosopher instead of a physicist. But philosophers, we believe ourselves to be the closest you can possibly get to science without actually using numbers. And so we believe in logic and rationality and all that other sorts of good stuff. We think that we are better than the soft sciences because we actually make sure that we can actually prove things before we can say that they're true. Probability and all that other sort of stuff. And I have found in philosophy, as I've become more interested in religion, this sort of curious thing that in analytic philosophy, you are not supposed to talk about God. You can talk about philosophy of religion, and most of the folks who do philosophy of religion also do philosophy of science. We all sort of look at them as if they're a little bit peculiar. But for the most part, if you're doing analytic philosophy, there's no discussion of God, unless you're talking about St. Anselm's proofs for the existence of God, if we have good rationality to support things. What I find peculiar is that I have recently begun to discover that lots of these analytic philosophers are also very religious.
Really?
But they hide it well. and
you mean like they go to the small Saturday night service at a Lutheran church? Or
well, actually, the folks... I haven't talked to them much about it, but they have this sort of just two different lives. And so for me as a philosopher, it's as I enter all of these discussions, I think I frustrate people who are religious, and I get frustrated because I'm always asking questions, and I always want to know the answer, and I want it to make sense. So the problem I have very frequently with faith and religion is that it's not been able to have been translated into a science language, which is the language I'm most comfortable with. So for me, there still is a tension, which I
won't do that translating. I'm still not able to do that.
I think the Plains Indians of Lakota refer to the creator as Wapan, the great mystery. And for myself, that's what God is. I have a friend who, older gentleman, we used to debate about anything. We'd pick a topic and we can argue. But he was a pretty serious agnostic, and he would argue Bible how God couldn't exist. And, you know, the rainbow, well, that's, you know, science has taken care of that. There's no mystery there. And so as we'd argue, we'd get in these things where, like Dan was referring to, you get more questions coming out. And so I'd let him go, and he'd prove that, you know, well, this couldn't happen, and this is the way it is, and we found this out, and there's this theory, and this is why there is no God. And we are becoming God. And I let him get to a point where he said, but we don't know this. And so that's where God is. God's in the little mysteries of life and the questions we don't know.
That's interesting. Most everybody has observed that. It's a certain humility, I think, in all that, in saying that the mystery is bigger than we understand, which is, in some ways, a problem for a systematic theologian to sort of get to that point too soon.
Become an easy cop-out. It's a trouble.
Right. They used to warn us as juniors at seminary, don't give the God is not in a box sermon, you know. that was the one that you would be crucified in class if you sort of said that you couldn't know about God. That was the thing you didn't want to say. And the Dan story was one, the other one that I was going to tell. I just was adamant about I would not surrender the creation story, just because I knew it was not science, and because scientific people were saying, well, it's just mere untruth. It's just mere fantasy, or, you know. And I knew there was more there, even before studying it or considering it, I knew there was more there than simply a tale. And I knew also that I could not sit down and say, yeah, the world was made in 6 days. And so it leaves you with a dilemma and a complicated task ahead of you. And I guess that's why I sort of stayed interested in science and ended up being a science teacher. As a physics teacher, nobody asks me that anymore. I just assume I have to... Well, I don't know what they assume. What I'm going to do now is I'm going to write this definition on the board. We're sort of narrowed down, and I'm going to write it so that you have time to sort of think about it. And it's my own, so it's open for criticism.
I'm trying to write big enough for everyone to see. But science, can you see that? No. Systematic exploration. Now, in exploration, I would say that you want to be as strict about that. It's first time, new knowledge. I mean, science class in third grade explores sometimes, but it's stuff that it's already there and we already know it. So
it's really study maybe instead of exploration. But scientists explore new stuff. And then what do you want to put? Of the natural world or physical world? Is that visible?
How about of the observable world?
Observable world? Okay.
Yeah, the natural tends to bifurcate.
Okay. Well, we'll leave this sort of... you're unsatisfied already. and then this one, I'm not sure anyone really insists on this other than me. Enhanced by... And this is what I got excited about science. Those apparatus, you know, devices. And only lately... by math, okay? And I'm glad you made that distinction, because science, you cross the line from philosophy to science when you introduce this, okay? And then this, attacking, and I wanted a strong word here, the data that you observe, okay? With a rigorous skepticism, with the aim of reaching universal consensus. Now, it's a little different word than holding usually.
Could you just turn on the lights over you? I think that would help us see the red.
So that was the word.
There it is. From what I've read, I read mostly physicists commenting on it. This is what they insist on. They say this is what defines science. And of course, they can do that.
The universal consensus.
Yeah, that they say that's what determines that something has arrived at scientific truth.
At that point in time, this is always moving.
How many hundreds of journal articles are published before they decided just universal consensus?
They haven't come very far, I don't think, but for instance, do you all know what this is?
Okay,
I think a physicist or chemist would say that you take this to planet Zork and they'll know what it is.
What is it?
This is the chemistry periodic table. And there is consensus. If you go to a chemist meeting in Japan or in China, Africa, the Soviet Union, the United States, they all agree on this. And maybe some minor details or not, but this is the consensus that I'm talking about there, universal consensus. And the interesting thing, scientists are those who study something new, they discover something new, they write papers about it, and then they invite people to disprove it, to test it. And at least from the physicist's point of view, if they can't repeat your experiment, you don't get to keep it. Now, that would be really an acid test for theologians. if you don't come out in the end with a consensus, you don't get to keep it. So, any comments on that? I know it's hard to see.
Read it again.
Systematic exploration of the world, the natural observable world, the physical world, enhanced by apparatus and mathematics, attacking the data with a rigorous skepticism with the aim of reaching universal consensus. Now, the line in there about apparatus and math always discourages my students. Some of the darkest days is when, in the life of an introductory physics student, is when they discover they want to be a model, and they discover they have to use math in a science class. And it's just really a dark day. The boys are always eager about the apparatus. I mean, there are some gender differences here. And studies show that you put boys in a laboratory, they will put themselves in charge of the equipment and they will break it. And it has some real interesting gender issues. You know, you teach, if you have a lab with just girls in it, they are excellent scientists. They're great observers. They're very careful. But there's complaints that you can't do that, though. That's, you know, sort of, that's not equity. So you put the boys in there, they'll push everybody out of the way, set the current generator in front of them, and nobody learns anything. It's a problem. But apparatus, and the whole thing with Galileo started because somebody introduced him to the telescope. It was a very crude one, but he turned it up, looked at the moon, and looked at Jupiter, and looked at Saturn, saw things that the church did not have in their natural history, and it started. The argument started. We'll talk about cosmology tomorrow. We'll talk about Galileo and the whole talk about how the heliocentric world tomorrow. But the apparatus and the math are crucial. For instance, let me just ask you that are scientists, math?
Math and statistics.
You took us on a tree hike yesterday. First thing you did was stop and count the rings of a tree. And statistics?
Very much so, yeah.
Okay. And measuring?
Measuring.
Yeah.
We get some fun apparatus. But
some of it is foreign to us, but if I ask you what time is it in Minneapolis right now? Anybody? Look at this.
1:24.
What?
1:24.
1:24. Put yourself back 500 years and think how amazing that thing is. You were a scientist, studied geology, math.
Yeah, when I finally got to the real quantitative part, that's when I switched to theology. Not like real fun stuff. But no, it's not there.
Yeah.
And calories and.
And what about the switch to the social science?
Switch to the social science? This has been very interesting this year. I came into a social science. As a quantitative researcher, I heard about qualitative research and thought they were somewhere between crazy and boring. And throughout the year, I am now at the place where I've just about made a complete switch. I'm not so interested in the predictability
mm-hmm.
of quantitative. Mm-hmm. I'm interested in the questions and the why and what's going on right now.
Okay. Yeah. But when you the mathematical methods of the social sciences are incredibly complex.
Yep.
It's all
statistics.
Gibberish to me. And their method. Yeah, well, lots of people have defined science as a particular method, and I think that's the grade school way of teaching it. Science, you prepare a hypothesis, you test the hypothesis, and then you draw conclusions. Well, and this, the methods that scientists use are broadly various, and I think we mislead children when we tell them that it's about a method. And I think that also discourages their curiosity. And you recognize in the great discoveries a lot of imagination and a lot of tenacity. You know, there's certain discipline preparation for that, but lots of times it's just an accident. Or it's an accident that happens in front of a very perceptive person. And sometimes the way to test hypotheses become the real problem. And that the imagination is what determines the success.
One thing I think is interesting, Joel, about it, and I see it in your definition there, is that, well, we saw this oftentimes in geology, that sometimes people who are very good at one part of it are lousy at the other. And one of the things that we saw with the increasing reliance on math, on quantitative, was that people's observation skills really begin to decrease. And before you had a lot of math, you really relied on field geology, on making very, very skillful, detailed observations on things. And then once you introduce the quantitative stuff, a lot of the real skill at doing good field geology starts to slip because people begin to rely on empirical testing through the apparatus and the map.
And so without both of them,
you need them both, yeah. And then you also have some people who are just real number crunchers and are very good at the technical stuff but don't have the imagination to put it together in the big picture.
Wow. Any other comments? Yeah.
I'm not sure that all scientists use apparatus or instruments of measurement, whether it be, you know, a gram scale weight or a questionnaire. I think theoreticians may not use apparatus. They may rely upon other people's observations, and particularly people like cosmologists may do a whole bunch of stuff manipulating mathematical ideas and relating that to some universal consensus or attempt to find a universal consensus.
All right. I guess I'm speaking from my, the little bit of science that I know. And like I said, I've been scared off from social science. That has been one discipline that's been sort of directly in competition for a long time with theology.
But I think your point, Joel, is that while any individual scientist may not use that or even feel, science as a general draws on each of those components. So like you say, people will build on other observations that people made. They may themselves not use a computer, but increasingly will build on that.
Okay, well, I'm going to draw my picture on the board and make some comment. First, I'm going to make an introductory comment that Mark Twain made. I think our discussion of science has shown that it's not the way we approach the faith, right? I mean, not math. The fact that we may have trouble with this word, but what we talk about in the faith is definitely not just this. That there's a difference in what we're observing or talking about. Apparatus has never really worked well in the church. With it, right? It's usually in the way. Think about our furnace. We tend to live and let live in the Protestant world, right? Mm-hmm. Academics will go with this rigorous skepticism, but what you do is not reject your thesis, you just form a little group. Right? And here, aim of reaching universal consensus, it's a great wish. It's a great hope. But we feel as Protestant denominations, we operate with a wide variety of views. And Mark Twain once set up the difference. I don't think he intended to be a comment about science, but he set up the difference. And somebody asked him, he said, "Mr. Clemens, do you believe in infant baptism?" He said, "It's a question, that's about the faith. Do you believe in infant baptism?" And he said, "Believe in it, mister, I've seen it." Now, and that's the sort of method of science. So he's contrasted that in there. And what I want to do is a way to set up this next week is to draw a picture here. And I think this is another two definitions that I want you to critique here. And it's sort of my working definition of the difference between the faith. And we'll use faith broadly right now. The faith, as the church has always talked about, the faith is our religion. The faith is sort of our activity, our sort of collection and arrangement of knowledge. And what the church tends to do, the church has an obligation, would you agree, to explain everything. I mean, to give us the big, broad outline of what the world is like. And when I went to seminary, we read ponderous translations of German theologies, and they would build a big house. They would, you know, start, the first chapter was about God. And I'm just going to put the I here, you know, God. And then there was the chapter about men. You know, and in the medieval church, that's what it was about. It wasn't necessarily about women, but men. And they were given a space and defined, and there was a real anthropology. And then talked about our purpose and about how all the natural worlds fit around it. And there were all sorts of intricacies in this structure. And would you agree that it's necessary for the church to give you comments and direction on your meaning, on what you're here for, why everything is here, you know, God's involvement in history, that is a necessary thing for a church to do, to build a structure. Even though all the details may not be apparent, they might be mysteries, they might be things you take on the authority of someone else, but would you agree that that's the responsibility of the teachers in a faith? Now, let's contrast that with science. Science, as it began, didn't have a house. And I'll just suggest that here was the house, and Galileo looked through the telescope, and he saw what were ears on Saturn. And it's fascinating to read his comments on this, but he got the telescope. He was kind of urgent to do it because some other scientists were going to preempt him on this, and he had to make a living, and so he wanted to know how it worked and make his own and sell them. And he focused in on that, and the structure that the church had given for the natural world said that all the celestial bodies were all perfect, they were all circular, spherical, and they represented the perfection of God. And he looked through and saw these flaws, and we'll talk about that more yesterday. But what happened was that science uncovered a footing for this structure that was completely outside the structure. And in the case of Darwin, you know, at that point the church still had this man, humanity. It was still sort of gender specific as the pinnacle of the creation and separate and above the animals. And Darwin discover this other sort of pillar out here, this other footing. And all of a sudden, can you imagine the reaction of those who are in charge of this plan? What would it be? Outrage. Fear. I don't think if this were my plan, somebody were doing stuff out here, I'd try to stop them. And that's exactly what happened. Now, do you think that's a fair description? Let me just summarize it here. Faith has an obligation to construct the framework and declare the nature of all the important pieces in it. It has to talk about our origins. It has to talk about the benchmarks of health and happiness and the nature of human beings and the place in the cosmos that we are supposed to occupy and our purpose and our enduring weaknesses, too, to talk about all of that and give us a framework out of which to live our lives. Science, on the other hand, although it probably aims at complete understanding, works on the small pieces, builds a brick at a time. And instead of a framework, builds by a consensus, one grudging brick at a time. And that's not to say it has limited ambition or that faith ignores the details of life. But faith starts with the plan, and science goes one brick at a time. And where faith must declare and believe, science has a very sacred obligation to doubt and test. And I think that leaves us with sort of the difficulties. And I was going to ask you to help me figure out how we hold those two things together. You can see where the conflict would come. Science continually lays a foundation that doesn't match
our theological structures. And what kind of reactions can we have? What can we do? We either, what?
Change the structures.
Enlarge the house.
I have a question instead of an answer. What's the difference between faith and theology? And the reason that I ask is that it seems to me that historically, or at least until very recently, people who were scientists were also doing theology. But you're talking about faith and not theology. So could you
let's say theology or religion.
Okay.
And talk about the sort of the body of knowledge. Because you're right, faith, I've been using a kind of sloppy fashion.
Well, the reason I ask is that it seems to me that historically lots of scientists have also been interested in theology. So I'm not seeing the split.
Yeah, well, I think historically the split is that Galileo and others, you know, very devout, Newton, Descartes, they were people who were very active and devout in the church. And what they suggested was that, just like Jim said, that you've got to rebuild the house. And they tried to do it in a very humble fashion to say that, you know, God's majesty and God's power is greater than we thought. And they suggested enlarging the house to include that. But the reaction of the church, sadly, was this was so valuable and had served for so long. And in a way, the church really depends and has an obligation to keep the tradition, and that structure is part of the tradition, that they were very unwilling to change and went to extremes. The stories of midnight assassination attempts on scientists by the Vatican, goon squads, are incredible. I mean, this is all sort of the church is fighting about what the structure looks like.
Joe, part of that isn't that because what science did was call into question the very credibility of the primary sources of knowledge for the church, that is the scriptures. And once it starts calling the credibility of that, it also calls into question the authority of those who interpret the scriptures, that is the leaders of the church. And so, I mean, it really calls into question the whole validity of the enterprise. Not by directly attacking it, but because science begins with a methodology that simply rules those as out of bounds as sources of reliable knowledge.
Right. And I think these scientists were willing to say that, and I think the way the church handled it was to split the two apart occasionally, to say the church will deal with issues of faith or revelation. I think they even went to the extreme in saying this is absolutely outside the realm of natural science. There's reason, and we'll let the scientists play with reason, but we'll keep control of the revelation. And the revelation says this, and there's no way science is going to change the revelation. And so
from the church's perspective, what the picture might have looked a little differently in that science maybe was digging a different foundation, and then digging a different foundation began to undermine the stability of the structure of the church had done until it begins
The question is whether science is even laying a foundation. Whether you can create a brick of knowledge and put it down, but that doesn't mean you have to do anything with it. Your schema here implies that science has a purpose. The goal is to create this house that we can all live in, and I'm not sure that that's necessarily what science is after.
Okay, that's a good point. And there are scientists who say, no, we don't theorize about the world, we just put the pieces together.
Or just find the pieces.
Yeah.
This may be just my personal theology growth, but I always thought, when I was younger and I seemed to be the whole church, saw man as the center of everything and the world as the center of everything. And I feel science is doing a really good job of showing us that we're just a part of the whole.
Yeah.
And like I say, I don't know if that's a general consensus or not.
Say that again.
I think science is doing a better job of showing us that mankind is a part of the whole, where religion has always had mankind up here and the rest of the world someplace else.
Yeah, I would agree. And my personal opinion was that this house was very inadequate. And I think, and maybe we have about
6 or 7 minutes. Now, I need to hear from you about implications. But one other thing that this suggests to me is that one of the great spiritual insights of science is this idea of doubt. I mean, sometimes faith and doubt are put as opposed to each other. But something in the Bible study suggested to me that doubt, that faith, that Jesus was recognizing this faith in these desperate people, that somehow you lose the faith, all of a sudden the sacrifices, the being the head of the synagogue doesn't work, and all your people and your mourners and your healers don't work. You lose the faith, and then, you know, then something else happens that you, and the word for the Greek word pistis means to rely on. And it's very different, I think, than the faith or the arrangement of knowledge we have as a church. It's something empty-handed and very different from all the things we've been talking about here. And I think that actually science can suggest, has suggested to me that doubt is much closer. The doubt that it you know, uses in a disciplined way is actually a spiritual asset. It's related to faith, it's related to humility. It somehow says that this is not the essential thing. Even though the church sort of has an obligation to say, you know, you're confirmed at 12 and you join the church and we'll take care of your problems, and has an obligation to say that we'll explain it all to you and we'll help you through. Science suggests that we're really maybe misleading people when we are too confident. Now I think that's close to heresy. And that's why I'm in a little church and they don't complain.
But it's desperate.
They need me there. And so I think that's one of the most sort of astounding. Because I've been struggling with being a pastor and being a physics teacher, and that's one of the most helpful things that I think science has taught me. It is said that in doing, in understanding, one has to sort of be restrained in building this, or at least be willing to change it. You know, the church. What's another example here?
Kind of the idea of having a structure that. Really looked like a structure, kind of blown apart when the new theologies have come in the recent years. I mean, like with liberation theology and African theologies that are developing and so forth. I mean,
My if we want to use that analogy for that, I think people are looking at sort of the pattern of the foundations that are being sort of dug up. And they're sort of erecting a temporary structure of knowledge that fits better. Because I think we've discovered that this one that put man at the center and sort of relegated everything else, nature, even non-Western humanoids, to something else, is inadequate. And I perceive from my little corner of the world that the church is in kind of a struggle between those who see a value in protecting this ancient tradition and this house that has been there for thousands of years and don't want to risk undermining the foundation or changing it at all, and the people who say, it doesn't work. This is not what's there. And so I would say that the experimental or the sort of provisional theologies that are saying we can make a better plan, we can fit more things in.
Well, I've studied theology rather recently, yeah. And I didn't really find that house or that structure. I mean,
it wasn't there.
No, I didn't see it.
Yeah, I've been out of seminary too long. I don't know exactly where I was torn down.
I think being somewhat more heretical,
Good.
There's probably, you know, I'm not saying there's probably, there are other houses there. You know, there are kind of apartments within that apartment building called Christianity. Mm-hmm. But guess what? There are other buildings. And if you want to invoke that necessity of a universal consensus, because that's kind of where I see you going or suggesting, I might be wrong.
Well, I think we've been sort of left with that with Jesus, right? I mean, he said that, maybe we've had a difficulty interpreting it, but said that I have other sheep that are not of this fold. Mm-hmm. And his aspirations were manifestly universal. Mm-hmm. But I think the church is built a little on the side where there was the other structure, the Muslim structure, they just didn't put any windows.
I can't
see that.
Okay. Yeah. And Judaism, someplace.
Sure.
Or, yeah, sure. Yeah.
Implications. Our time's about up. But one is that, and it's maybe just an aside here. Not many of us do science, and I'm troubled by that as a teacher. But what happens is that although science is this wonderful, refreshing way of learning new things, there are very few people that actually engage in the discipline of it. And most science is learned by authority, just the way the ancient church learned about, you know, the Trinity, just the way we learn our catechism. You go into class, you sit down, somebody says, learn it. And I say two-thirds of my students say, well, just give me the numbers and tell me what the letter stands for, and I can fill them in, but I don't understand it.
What do I need to know for the test?
What do I need to know for the test? And so I think most of us engage in learning from some other authority, and the church has always sort of gloried in that. Science has sort of lost its freshness that way, because now there's so much that you got to learn before you can do any of that, and not many people get to engage in the discovery, and it sort of comes to a second and third hand. And I think that's one of the reasons kids aren't excited about science anymore, and why science is sort of, I mean, you see scientists writing these books that indicate they're nervous and that they're in crisis, you know, that they're worried that science is going to lose its hegemony in our society, and that's because very few people get to do it, and that's one. How about any other implications? I know this should close pretty soon.
Well, that's quite a contrast to theology these days, because everybody's doing theology. I mean, and I don't, you know, want to stop that, but I mean, I think I'm from California, I can see lots of theology.
Sure, sure.
Don't have houses necessarily. I mean, yeah. They're just individual.
Well, and I think the challenge, and here I am, you know, we talk about science, end up talking about the challenge to the church, is what, how permanent or how flexible and how big the framework we give to our people. We know now that we have to include all sorts of people and creatures that we sort of could marginalize before. It's just the world, we need them. And when we go back and look at the Genesis story, it's obvious, you know. And yet, 200 years ago, they could read that and they could read the story of Genesis and say, you see, Adam was the first king. This is the story where primogeniture occurred, because he was the firstborn, and that made him king, and that established the doctrine of royalty that you know, Americans manifestly rejected and sort of fall in love with again with the royals. Looking again at it, what's the challenge to the church is that it be a bigger, more flexible structure. And I think if it does that, science ceases to be an enemy. Science becomes the place where we uncover more of the stuff we need to build an adequate framework.
So you're talking about some of the implications. One of the things that always bugged me so much, and it was so hard to understand Christianity's defensive reaction was that in the Gospel of John, it has that wonderful line, you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. And yet it seemed like so many of us in the church were so defensive against any investigations into truth and to understand reality that we couldn't control. But I think there are some places that, you know, both sides can learn each other, because the flip side of that is science, disconnected from any sort of accountability or responsibility to the earth, can lead to terrible, horrible results when it gets done. And so I think, you know, religions can bring some sense of humility, some sense of perspective, some sense of accountability, and that science is not an inherent part of science.
Okay, and so maybe the science is incapable of doing those things by itself.
Pretty much outside of it, but science can also help break down some of the parochialism and authoritarianism of religion, I think, as well, by constantly challenging.
Yeah, it's maybe a good relationship. We'll talk about this more in the week. The next session will be on the cosmology, planets, and astronomy. The next one will be about the environment, the other creatures that, and the creation. And then the third one after that will be on human beings, the anthropology. And I hope we can talk more about that. Okay. So thank you very much. I think we're talking.